Hi, this is Sharin, and you're listening to Vocal Local. I'm talking to Sue Bradford, who's over on Waiheke for the Super City submissions to the Select Committee, because you're on the Select Committee. So how's it going?
It's a very intense process. We're listening to full days of submissions, 5 days a week, for 3 weeks here in Auckland, before going back to Wellington to consider all the submissions that we've heard. And, of course, there's many hundreds of submissions and a lot of very angry people around Auckland, not just here in Waiheke, but all over the region.
So what are the things that you're hearing? What are the general trends that are coming out?
People are very anxious about the Super City model, about the speed with which it's been inflicted on the population, about the lack of consultation, and there's a lot about local control and people wanting to retain their local identity. One of the main issues coming through is that people really want the local community boards or community councils to have real powers, to have funding for the people that would be elected onto those local boards or councils to be paid enough to make it worthwhile their doing it, really to maximise local control. And at the same time as ensuring that the new Super City Council is as democratic as possible. So the themes that we're hearing on Waiheke, while having a very clear Waiheke slant and perspective, are actually very similar to what we're hearing in other parts of the city, like, say, Manukau, Waitakere, Papakura.
Mm. And so how are these submissions different?
The criticism of Auckland Council is extreme. I mean, it's obviously been an absolutely shocking experience, and what happened with the Cleanstream contract has put the lid on it in terms of people's anger here, and I totally understand that anger, and I just find it intolerable what Auckland Council has done to this community and what it's done to the waste community waste project, which is, you know, one of the most wonderful waste and recycling projects of the country, actually demonstrating how people can create their own jobs doing something that's environmentally wonderful, just of course what the Green Party's all about. And so we look to projects like this as the way of the future, and to think that a council would actually take that away from the community and instead replace it with this failed multinational is just unbelievable in 2009.
Mm. So one of the things that really struck us is this constant talking about the bottom dollar. When you look at business, often people say, you know, price is a factor, but it's seldom in the top four things that people think about. And for us, it's really been around this culture in Auckland City Council, that there seems to be a culture of favouring particular interests over other interests. And we feel that they could have been a lot more creative, even if they buy into their figures of it being more expensive, given the fact this was a community-based enterprise generating money within the community, that there could have been a way of finding money elsewhere to support that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shocker. I mean, the culture at Auckland City goes back decades, and while the Green Party has been opposed to the whole, at one level, to what's been happening with the Super City legislation, on the other hand, we also see it as an opportunity for massive change in a positive way in local government in Auckland. And I've welcomed the submissions we've had from people who are actually looking at the positive side of it to say, well, it's about time we change the culture of what's happening, this corporatist culture, this favouring the rich at the expense of the poor, favouring business over the environment and so on. All
so
of that needs to change. And so I think that it's good to see people seeing this as an opportunity as well as a threat, and that a lot of these people the people that have done this terrible thing with Waiheke's waste, that they could perhaps will be gone shortly. Perhaps we could have a new council of the Auckland region, which is dominated by left-leaning social justice and environmental interests, by the 4 key sustainability principles. What if we had a council on that basis? What if we had powerful local boards or local councils, including one here on Waiheke, who had a lot of power to determine Waiheke's own affairs, to build community, to build environmental sustainability, to support things like the Biosphere Project? I think it's good to look optimistically, not just negatively, at what's happening. And of course a lot of the submitters are.
Well, I think one of the issues is that we feel that we submit all the time and we never seem to get anywhere. Having said that, it was quite encouraging to hear Nikki Kaye talk about a village model. Is that something that seems to be generally supported?
Well, John Carter's the chair of the Select Committee and a government minister, so hopefully when he speaks he's got something behind him. He's been indicating right through the process that the government is looking seriously at things like much greater powerful community boards or community councils, at they're considering the question of whether to go to multi-member wards rather than having at-large councillors. They're certainly looking at Māori, restoring Māori representation and so on. So there's an indication that the government is going to improve this legislation hugely. Whether that actually happens, of course, I've got no idea because the Green Party's not part of government. But we'll be doing everything we can to improve this legislation from where we sit.
Are you feeling quite hopeful about it?
I'm feeling reasonably hopeful, but we're not sitting inside the national government, so we don't know. But there's so much pressure, and the voices from around the region are so clear and strong. It doesn't matter where you sit in the region, apart from voices like that of Auckland Council, that I hope that national will realise that it's really got to do a lot better.
And I think, well, someone sitting, either you or someone sitting next to you, suggested or was questioning where the money would come from. So if you empower the local boards, who's going to, you know, pay those higher salaries or, you know, where's
that
money going to
come
from?
Well, that has to come out of the rates. I mean, it has to come from the same source as the council. But that's only fair enough.
Mm. Well, I think
to me, it's a
redistribution of the wealth.
Absolutely, it needs to be redistributed fairly. And so I'd see it, I'm just off the top of my head, you know, perhaps two-thirds goes to the Auckland Council and another third goes to the local councils or something like that. I mean, that's just a rough equation, but acknowledging that there has to be real money, real resources and real power and statutory power going to the local boards or local councils, otherwise they won't have any meaning and we'll just have the sort of community boards that we have at the moment, which on the whole are quite, a lot of people are quite dismissive of them. You obviously have quite a good community board here on Waihihi, but in other parts of the city people are pretty critical of them for just being a waste of time and money because they've got no power and don't do much.
Well, I think that's right. We have good individuals on the community board, but they are fairly powerless. I mean, take this whole issue around the waste.
Yeah, they couldn't stop what happened.
And what are the chances of...
Oh, good, you're coming... Because it'd be good to catch up.
I'll get you... Where are you guys going?
Just down here.
Oh, okay. Did you want to go?
Oh, it's okay. Yeah.
What are the chances of this all being legislated, that the power of community boards is legislated for, as opposed to just something that the Greater Auckland Council bestows on community boards?
The community boards absolutely must be given power through the legislation that we're about to pass. It can't just be let up. Nothing should be left to the discretion of council because... It's far too dangerous. We actually have to legislate. And I'm hoping that, I mean, a lot of people have raised social issues, the lack of anything to do with social issues, environmental issues, community development, the sort of stuff we were talking about this morning. I'd love to see in this bill ways of ensuring that there's some responsibility at both the local and at the super council level. That would change the culture that you've got with Auckland City Council so that both the Auckland Council overall and the local councils are actually legislatively empowered and encouraged to work in a genuine community development kind of way and to have genuine regard for all sustainable principles, including those of social responsibility as well as environmental integrity.
Mm. And what are the chances of having John Banks as a super mayor?
Well, that's the big political question, and I hope that the right will divide itself by having these celebrity candidates stand against each other, the Paul Holmeses of this world standing against John Banks. I mean, those sort of options are good, because what I'd love to see is a candidate that the left and green community groups, unions, people across the city, across the region, if we could come together and support one mayoral candidate, that would be ideal, and leave the right to divide itself. Because in the end, this isn't just about processes and political infrastructure, it's about political power, and that comes down to votes. And if we don't get organised and have a really good ticket for mayor, for the overarching council, and for good local community councils, if we don't have good tickets for those, wherever we live in the region, the right will continue to hold the kind of power that's been wielded so disastrously against Waihiki.
Hi, you're listening to Vocal Local. I'm talking to Sue Bradford, and we're just going to be talking about the smacking bill or the anti-smacking bill. So can you just talk about the consequences of that bill? It's been passed and, what's the effect of that been so far?
Just over 2 years ago, my private member's bill that removed the defence of reasonable force for the purpose of correction from New Zealand law and gives children the same protection from violence as adults have. In that period, there hasn't been the kind of outcome that our opponents at the time this bill was being debated told the population there would be. We haven't seen hundreds of thousands of parents arrested and dragged off before the courts for hitting or whacking their children. We haven't seen hundreds of children removed from the home because of one inconsequential assault. The sort of things that Bob McCroskey from Family First and others threatened would happen before my bill became law just have not eventuated.
Has anyone been prosecuted?
The amendment to Section 59 of the Crimes Act did not result in a new law being created, so there was no new offence created. What happened was that there always has been an offence of assault on children, but there used to be this defence which allowed some parents to get away with quite badly beating their children. That defence is being removed. So it's not like people can be prosecuted under a new law. So it's quite hard for people to get their heads around that. But what has changed is that there is no legal defence for hitting, whacking, smacking, beating our children anymore. A lot of our opponents say, well, it hasn't made any difference. In the old days, there weren't many court cases anyway. But what used to happen in the old days was that mostly the police would not take prosecutions against parents in many cases where they assaulted their children because they had this defence available to them. But the real significance of the law change is that what we're seeing is a gradual shift in how people see children in New Zealand, and that more and more parents and grandparents are coming to understand that bringing up our children without violence is actually the best way of going, and that seeing children as being something to hit as part of bringing them up isn't really that great for them or for us as adults. And that there's beginning to be some research which is showing that public opinion is shifting on that, which is partly due to a lot of good parent education that's been happening about alternatives to violence, but it's also due to the law change itself. And the debate we've had around the law change is more and more people come to understand that positive parenting is a much better way to go.
So that's been a really positive outcome.
It is, but it'll take a long time. And in other countries where they've changed their laws like this, it always does take a long time to shift the culture. And, of course, we still see far too many children being battered and hurt.
Which I'm always quite surprised about, that the statistics in New Zealand are quite high for the battering of children.
Very high, which is why I saw it as so important to try and make this law change. When we had 2 years with my bill in front of the Select Committee, and we heard evidence from all sorts of people, including paediatricians and doctors, and it was really tragic evidence about, I mean, you hear about the murdered children, but there are children and babies every day battered by their parents. And usually what the paediatricians told us was that the battering usually happened, even for three-month-old babies, is in the name of discipline. I just had to teach her, or I had to teach him toilet training or whatever it was, not to shit themselves or something like that. And so they hit them, whack them, shake them. Just hit them around the ear. I mean, that can give brain damage if you hit a baby around the ear. No understanding of the consequences of the actions. And I was brought up with this violence. Didn't do me any harm. I bring up my own children that way. It's the best thing for them. Otherwise, they'll turn into criminals. It's very illogical, but it's the product of centuries of a belief system which says we should actually bring up our children with violence because it's the best way of bringing them up. And it's very hard to change that deep-rooted psychology.
So do you think it's a kind of a culturally ingrained practice, or is it that in New Zealand more cases come to light than in other countries? Or...
Both. I think it is a religiously and culturally ingrained practice that our colonial Pākehā ancestor settlers brought with them from Victorian Europe, England, in the 19th century, brought the idea that it was legal to beat your wife, legal to beat your child. That practice was brought with our ancestors to this country. But on top of that, we had a settler pioneer culture that was very violent, and that still seems to be the case, that there's a lot of violence against women and children, as we know, and men actually.
Is there also something in a Polynesian culture around acceptability of hitting children, or is that not?
Pacific Island people were colonised by the Christian some Christian churches, and that theology, which some Christians have, that you should beat the evil out of children, is unfortunately shared by some of those Christian churches. Pacific Island people have been particularly affected by that. Mm. There's violence in the family throughout Pākehā, Māori, Pacific Island and other ethnic communities, and it's something that happens in all cultures.
I've often wondered if it's also the fact that the way people live in New Zealand in isolated houses and in nuclear families also contributes to the stress existing in families, and also means that your neighbour doesn't necessarily hear the violence that goes on within a home. Because if you live in a tower block in Barcelona, you can hear things through the wall, so you can hear things aren't right.
Yeah, I think the social isolation in the way a lot of us live and that we sort of were brought up to live has helped people to see the home as the castle. I mean, I grew up in a time when kids were just beaten and wives beaten all the time, and no one did a thing about it. I mean, no one knew. It was kept secret. And I'm very glad that culture of secrecy, we're trying to break that wide open, because that's how violence and abuse and humiliation flourishes. Mm. And we've got to do everything we can to change that. But yes, living in social isolation is certainly a factor.
So could I just ask you, what's the story now with this referendum? I was quite surprised. I was at home. I get this thing through the mail. What is that? Can you explain what we're supposed to be voting on and how it came about?
It came about because those who were opposed to my bill becoming law started a petition while the bill was still in front of Parliament, and they wrote that really confused question very deliberately. They wanted to maximise the number of signatures they got, and they had to get a huge number of signatures, and they achieved it with that very confused and confusing question, which now a lot of people don't know how to answer. I think it's really crook that we should have to spend $9 million of the taxpayers' money having a referendum on such a question that a lot of people, what is this about?
So do you remember the question?
Should a smack as part of... It's basically, should a smack as part of good parental correction be an offence, something like that? And I've put up another private member's bill now, saying that in future, if people put up these referendum questions again, they should always, the clerk of the House who approves the question should not approve a question that's confusing or ambiguous or complex or leading or misleading, and that's defined. And I'm hoping that the government will pick that up so we don't waste money again on this, and so that a question wouldn't go to a petition without it being a clear yes. They have to be yes or no answers, but it should be a clear yes or no question so people know what they're voting on. But now we're stuck with this question. There's nothing that can happen with this particular referendum. I'm really encouraging everyone who wants to keep the law as it is to vote yes, because voting yes is voting yes for children to have the same protection and law as adults. That is that we don't have the reasonable force defence. People who are voting no are voting to change the law so that parents will once again have a defence when they beat or whack or hit their children.
So basically vote yes on the referendum.
It's a postal referendum that goes from the 31st of July till midway through August, so it starts really soon. If you want to know more about what's behind the yes vote and why people like me are saying that you should vote yes, because it is quite hard, because of the strange question, it's quite hard to work that out. There's a really good website called the Yes Vote website, so just go to Yes Vote.
And I'll put that up on the blog. So
that'd be great, because there's heaps and heaps of background information there. If you really want to get into it, or you have questions about, you know, why vote yes, or, yeah, what's this all about, go to the Yes Vote website, or to the Green Party website too. We've got material there as well.
Lovely. Well, Sue, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's great to have you over on the island.
Fantastic to be here on Waiheke again.